As was said, my topic is talking about for reducing Fumonisin and contamination in corn using breeding strategies. So why are we interested in Fumonisins? I think any of us walking through a cornfield have seen ear rots like that. And this particular ear rot is caused by a fungus called Fusarium verticillioides. One of the challenges that we have with this is, in addition to reducing grain quality, this fungus produces a variety of toxins, most notably Fumonisin. And the Fumonisins exist in a family, FB1, FB2, FB3, FB4, and then the G families. FB1 is primarily the most common out there. And so one of the challenges that we have, is that there really is no correlation between Fusarium ear rot and Fumonisin levels. And so you can have an ear rot and not have any Fumonisins. You can also have very healthy looking grain and have very high levels of Fumonisins. So what we're trying to do in our program is to figure out a breeding strategy so we can screen for both ear rot and screen for toxin resistance. I'm going the wrong way. I keep getting this button confused here. Okay. So the questions I always like to ask, why do we breed for this? And sorry for the pictures, but we need to understand this. Fumonisins have both human and animal diseases that are linked to the toxicity. This is porcine pulmonary edema, and you can see the blood that's oozing out. And then also equine leukoencephalomalacia, which basically is the rotting of a horse's brain. And it can't see it very well on here, but where these little arrows are, there's little holes that actually occur in the brain, and the brain literally turns into jelly. And my first exposure to this particular symptom is I was invited to go to the University of Illinois to the vet school, and this is when I worked for Syngenta, and we were starting our breeding program, and I had to justify to my boss why I was doing all this, and we went in and they cut open the horse's head, and basically its brain just rolled out, and I was like, I know why we're doing this now, and so it became pretty dramatic. And so you can see, and the other thing too, in the U.S. it's not so much a problem, but if you go to China and a few other, South Africa, it's been associated with esophageal cancer, especially in countries where there's very high level of corn in their diet. The United States, we for the most part, don't eat 400 grams of corn a day. We eat more like about 10 to 15. But nonetheless, we have very limited data on what the health impacts are on humans in the United States right now because we don't monitor for it. I'm doing it again. The real reason why we're looking at this is because they are regulated. The European Union, right down here, the 1st of October of this year, these are the regulations that they put into place. Some people may say, well, you know, we don't ship a lot of corn to the European Union. This is very true. The European Union imports a lot of corn from other countries. Those countries are also increasing their regulations to match the European Union. We ship corn to those countries. And so it's a round robin circular way, but nonetheless, this has now been set as the standard. We now as a country have to accept this whether we want to or not. And so as we start moving grain around the world for either human food or as an animal feed, we are going to be impacted by these regulations. Get it right this time. So there's also a geographic distribution that's important, and part of this comes from public information, part of this comes from private information, and these are generalizations. If you were to go to the different states in the United States and just start randomly grabbing corn and screening for different toxins, if you started up in the northern part of the United States, primarily, you'd see a toxin called deoxynivalenol. Sometimes you'd see fumonisins, and very sporadically, you'd see aflatoxins. But if you go to the central corn belt of the United States, you'd occasionally see deoxynivalenol. Primarily, you'd see fumonisins, and occasionally see aflatoxin in drought years. This region right here is kind of a transition zone, and I say sporadic, and actually, all of these occasionally, and it's probably increased over that, especially as we've gone to more corn on corn. However, if you go to the southeast and the southern states, it's primarily aflatoxin, primarily fumonisins, and we're now starting to see higher increases of deoxynivalenol as we're sampling down there. So, and the reason why we see differences is because the fungi that produce these toxins, they have temperature regimes that are very important for them. And these fungi, unfortunately, are able to adapt. And that's actually what's happening right in the Corn Belt. Because we have such high volumes of corn, these fungi have basically found a very unique niche here. So why is that important? And we've heard, and we will hear through this week, about byproducts from fuel ethanol industry. This is where the highest concentration of biofuel plants are located. This is where the grain is being used. One of the challenges and why fumonisins are becoming more important is they are concentrated three times in the byproducts. So if you start out with a one part per million corn, which is below the threshold, the byproducts that come out of the fuel ethanol side that are going to be used for animal feed are now three parts per million. And so the push now is to try to understand and to come up with remedy solutions for that. The dry grind ethanol process is the primary one. There's probably 75% of all the plants. There are newer plants coming online where they actually will be taking the germ out through a processing on the front end so they can realize higher value products. And by doing that, we will reduce the level of fumonisin in the byproducts, but we don't know how that's going to happen yet because we've not had a chance to evaluate that. This is a very classic example. This is about, though, half a mile from my house. And this is one of our larger growers in the Peoria, Illinois area. This is his elevators, and this is his drying bins behind us. He has produced so much grain that he is just dumping it on the outside right now. And you can see where there are streaks coming down through there. We've had some rain. And he's been kind enough to let me sample this, and I sampled it when he started dumping the grain, and I've been sampling every week while this is going on. All of this grain is destined for the pet food industry. All right, I'll tell you that right now. When we started sampling out here, there was about one part per million fumonisins, because this was a pretty nice year for us. It wasn't real nasty for making the toxins. But it was just packed. Every kernel of grain had Fusarium verticillioides in it. As it's been sitting outside, and it's now aged about 3.5 weeks, you can see the darkened areas out here. You can actually see the mold growing on the grain. The last sample that I took out of here was 140 parts per million. The European Union's regulations are 2 parts per million. So we've already gone over that, and I'm told him basically I don't want to know which dog food he's sending and selling it to, but this is a challenge. So why do it? Historically, ear rot resistance was visual. I've said that before. You get a bad looking ear, you throw it away. The problem is with fumonisins and with Fusarium verticillioides, it can grow within these kernels and you won't see it. And I know everybody who's been in corn breeding all knows this. You have different major heterotic groups and you do various combinations, and that's how we get the hybrids that we sell today. When we start looking at the different heterotic influences, we can see that the iodines, by and large, and this is just a small subsample of what we've been looking at, the iodines for fumonisin probably give us the most resistance, and the stiff stalks are the most susceptible that are out there. And what's interesting is if you look at the ear rot score, they're all basically the same, but if you look for fumonisins, and we've done this for the other toxins as well, the iodines typically have the best score, and the stiff stalks typically have the highest score. And so since most of the germplasm that's used commercially is the stiff stalk, that's why we typically have higher levels of fumonisins. So some more of the challenges that we have. This is from a paper that Gary Munkfold, who's speaking in another session right now, and Anders Jardins from my group put out back in 1997, looking at the ways how this fungus can get into the plants. And the corn industry, the seed companies basically, when BT corn was coming onto the market, we contracted with Gary Munkfold at the time to show that what's the influence of BT. And what we really found out was that by controlling these insects, especially the European corn borer, you could really knock down the level of fumonisin contamination. Didn't eliminate it. And the reason why is there because all of these other mechanisms and avenues of entrance would take place, especially when you have contaminated debris material and the spores are windblown onto the silks. The silks are the key right now. If you can figure out a way to control the fungus from growing down the silks, you'll have a potential mechanism. Another really important thing that has been overlooked for the most part from the breeding folks is that the pathogen, Fusarium verticillioides, is a true endophyte of corn. plant needs the fungus needs the plant. And so you can take a very healthy looking kernel and put it onto a petri plate and you'll see the fungus grow out from it. And essentially, every kernel of corn that's produced in the Corn Belt has this fungus in it to some level of contamination or not. And more importantly, I think, too, is since this fungus is in here, when you have drought conditions, the fungus is going to try to do what it can to protect itself. And so one of the dogmas is that when these fungi are stressed, either by heat stress or drought stress, they start producing these toxins to keep all the other pathogens away from it so they can have their own nutrient source. And that's kind of hard to prove, but it's, you know, no one's disproved it yet, so I guess it's pretty decent. So what are our goals? Our goal is basically to develop germplasm with improved Fusarium ear rot and fumonisin resistance, and we want to make sure that it has still a high yield potential for high yield environments. We want to simultaneously test for these resistance along with drought tolerance at multiple locations. We're going to be utilizing what we call managed stress environments, and the seed industry is moving that way quite a bit, and we want to utilize limited irrigation sites where possible. And ultimately our goal is to release this germplasm so it'll be used by the industry. So how do we do this? This is looking out the back of my building. This is my nursery, okay? Compared to like all the big universities, I don't have anything, okay? So But what I do have that most people don't have is I have a place in the winter I can bring in exotic germplasm. The room is about the size of this room that we're in right now. It's got HEPA filters in it. We've got grow lights. We can manage the amount of water that we give those plants. And so we can be very nasty to the plants. And the materials that survive, we can then take out to our nurseries. We actually have probably a little over 2.5 acres here that we can use. And then ultimately what we want to do is start moving these things to our stress environments. This is a slide, this portion of the slide is from Pioneer Hybrids. This is at their Woodland, California facility. They're one of our collaborators. And what they've done is they have drip irrigation underneath here, and so they can basically shut down the water on each one of these rows at any given time. And I'll talk more about what we call full irrigation, mild stress, and severe stress later on. But so they can do some very nasty things in the field. And so between these three, the cycle we've got here, I think we stand a decent chance of hitting something. So how did we do this? We were interested, there was a plant disease paper that was published in 2007, but we actually were working with the IATA folks a little bit before that. And they have been doing a lot of breeding work for aflatoxin resistance. And at the same time, they've also started a program for looking at fumonisin resistance. And so I contacted them, they sent us a bunch of their lines, and then in order to help get it into germplasm that the private industry would look at, we simply went and used the PVP lines that were the certifications that have expired. And the reason why I chose that is because those have all been markered already. The private industry knows what they look like. They have experience working with them. And so it's not going to be something, pardon pun, foreign to them. And so I did this by consult with the private industry people, and they said that was the way to go. And so what we did, this is just a small section of a bigger table. We just simply took our temperate lines and we delayed them 7 days in our growth room to see if we can improve our NIC with the materials from Nigeria. And one of the challenges that we found out is that our Nigerian material, some of the lines just did not like the NIC very well at all. And so I just wanted to show you that just because they're a line doesn't mean that they are well coordinated. But we were able to get some of the seed out of this, and we then put it out in our nursery this year. We selfed everything, we backcrossed everything for yield trials seed for FY08. And then we also wanted to start bringing in other sources of resistance, and GE440 from Crop Science, there was a paper that was put out on that. And we had been working with that beforehand, and it seems like it's a decent inbred for us. And then we also wanted to bring in a source of European corn borer resistance, and so we went back to an older Crop Science paper, and we looked at DE811. And we had some pretty decent successes with those as well. So what are the challenges for us? I don't have any fumonisin data. We're still doing that right now, and didn't want to present just partial stuff. But some of the material from Nigeria doesn't quite have the level of resistance that we want. The GE440 material probably is a little bit better than a couple of the lines. So our challenge, and this is my spiel to USDA, coming from private industry to the USDA, I have lots of resources, and I still do to this day, but if you notice in the Corn Belt, there's not a lot of USDA breeding that's going on. We've got the GEM project at Ames. And so folks that I can partner with, for the most part, are in the southern area, which is fantastic, because they constantly get high levels of fumonisin and aflatoxins. The challenge for me is getting that germplasm that's adapted for down here back up to the Corn Belt and have it in a format that seed companies will enjoy looking at. And so also, fumonisin resistance breeding has not been the primary focus for germplasm down in this region. Most of it's been aflatoxin. That is changing. And the germplasm maturity, as I said, is later than what is desired for the Corn Belt. And so we're still working. Paul Williams from down in Mississippi, he and I are talking about exchanging information in germplasm. The folks over in Raleigh, 2 weeks ago, we had a meeting in Atlanta for the aflatoxin fumonisin working group of the USDA, and we're setting up germplasm exchange as well with them, and we're going to try to early up some of theirs, and they're going to lighten up some of ours. One of the possibilities that was suggested to me was a program that's called CIRAT, and again, it's primarily focusing on with aflatoxins, but and it's being tested primarily throughout the southern part of the United States, and we could possibly include some of our material in there. Again, this is primarily focusing on aflatoxins, and so our germplasm has not been selected very strongly for aflatoxin resistance, so I would expect we would do pretty poorly there, but it does give us locations to look at. So one thing that we're really interested in doing is looking at managed stressed environments, and the USDA down in Tifton has a stress environment test on there. We are building one in Peoria. Longmont, Colorado, this is Syngenta, is Longmont and Gilroy. They have testing sites there. And Pioneer Hybrids, as I mentioned earlier, they have a site in Woodland, California. And then on the island of Kauai, on the south side near Waimea, it's a fairly stressed environment down there, and there's lots of irrigation. So if you stop your irrigation, you can get fairly good disease take. And so one of the things that we want to do, this is a picture from what was at Tifton. They have what they call rainout shelters, and you simply stick that over your corn, and you physically can control how much irrigation and how much water goes in there. And we're looking into building several of those up at the Peoria Center as well. So this is more, again, goes back to the Pioneer stuff, and you can see that full irrigation and drought, the drought stress is, and here's where soaking is, 50% soaking. So basically, you go out a week or so, maybe 10 days prior to mid-soak. And then out here, it's like 2 to 3 weeks before mid-soak. And then you stress it a little bit further after that, and then you resume irrigation again. And you can see some very dramatic influences. And they've had very good success for screening their germplasm for drought resistance, as well as fumonisin resistance. So our future work, we're going to look at more testers, and we're going to look at changing our heterotic patterns a little bit. And we're also going to be looking at white corn. All of the material coming from Nigeria is white corn. And then we're also in discussions with both Pioneer and with Syngenta to get some of their stack traits. We're going to expand our resources. We're going to take advantage of what's going on in the GEM program. We've just received access to the Major Goodman's allelic diversity collection. Those are being marketed right now by Syngenta, so we know what we've got. We're going to continue to develop our stress breeding locations, and we're entering into long-term research agreements. The challenge for us is high-throughput fumonisin assays. Most of it, we do work with LCMS. That's very problematic, just for sheer numbers. The ELISA kits, there are some problems with them, but we're going to do that for our first initial screens, and we're hoping to get that with a robot here pretty soon. And then our long-term goal is to get markers on here. Paul Williams and I have been discussing this, and hopefully we'll be able to achieve that. And I want to acknowledge Pioneer DuPont, Syngenta, IATA, and Carrie Mayfield at Texas A&M, and Bozu Gao at USDA. And with that, I'll take any questions. It's a very large problem. In fact, they actually have problems with aflatoxin and fumonisins. And the challenge that we have in that part of the world is they're basically subsistence farmers. So they're going to keep their corn all as much as possible. And what they'll do is the corn that's their best looking corn is what they're going to export to other countries, primarily the European Union. And so what the IITA has been doing is going out and surveying all of the best corn, bringing that into their collection, and then starting to breed out from that. And their hope is to basically displace the land races that are currently being used and give them hybrid corn or, you know, corn that has more resistance to it, and just give it to them and let the farmers, so they don't have to constantly worry about the corn that they're going to eat having high levels of aflatoxin and fumonisins. Yes?
A follow-up question to that. Is anyone monitoring the maizes being eaten in Central America where it's such a high percentage of the diet, particularly in young children?
I don't know. That I don't know. And
is there a monitoring program?
It's not very strict. There's one going on in Nicaragua that monitors aflatoxin.
Right, okay. Aflatoxin is the one that everybody goes after because it will kill you. Fumonisins won't kill you outright, but they'll sure make you feel pretty bad. Mm-hmm. And so the guidelines around the world are much stricter for aflatoxin than fumonisins. But I strongly suspect as we start to look and monitor fumonisins around the world, the guidelines are going to increase in strictness as well. Yes, sir.
What are the drought threats?
Because I can do drought stress, I can't necessarily do nitrogen stress. That's something down the road. I was just talking. We have locations where we can do drought stress right now. I do know from my field experience at Peoria, and we have one field that just has very, very low nitrogen, and it has not just the ear rot, but the overall disease resistance packages just fall apart under that the low nitrogen. And so that's something that we're interested in, but it's on the next round of projects we're going to do. Yes?
You implicated about the doctors and the transmission to this area. What are your thoughts on the maize?
I think it's important as well. We have some very good work. Pat Dowd, a different group in the USDA at Peoria, he's looking at a variety of other non-lab insects. And they are probably equally, if not more important.